There's of course also the fact that she never had any help from, like we believe in the wild, that they have help from older dolphins when they give birth and raise their young. She'd never had that guidance. There's any number of reasons, but certainly the fact that she and her baby were going to be spending the rest of their lives in captivity has come up as one of the reasons.
I just wanted to ask a question about captivity. I think for a lot of people listening to the program, they probably know why animals in captivity suffer. But I was wondering if you could just describe to us why your group has been protesting and what the conditions are like for the dolphins. Why is this something that your group cares so much about? And what are the conditions for the dolphins like at the aquarium at the West Edmonton Mall?
Well, I think, first of all, we have to realize that this is inside a shopping mall. I can't think of a more unnatural place to put animals than, you know, wild animals, than inside a shopping mall. There's a lot of reasons why we were concerned, just sort of pretty obvious ones, like the fact that the lights are always on. The dolphins don't get to experience any kind of night and day. It's really noisy. You know, there's pipe music all the time, the clatter of people all day long. And then there's also one thing maybe most people don't think about, and that is the constant hum of the, you know, a noise of heating equipment and other sort of just mechanical devices out there. So there's that aspect. There's the fact that they're forced into fairly constant interactions with people, both their trainers and the public. It's a small tank up until, I think it was a few months, actually, before Howard left. The water was heavily chlorinated to keep it free of bacteria and that. So it was just a really, really unhealthy environment for the dolphins. And, of course, I mean, there's things that go on everywhere. It's a concrete tank with absolutely no stimulation for the dolphins anywhere. And, you know, you just sit there and watch the dolphins circle around and around and around. That's all they could do.
Mm-hmm. So Howard was finally relocated after many years of protest, and all of us were, you know, in the throes of victory thinking, wow, West Ed finally bowed to the protest. But now they've brought in the sea lions after us thinking they were going to ban all exotic animal acts from the mall. So now what? Now what? What is your plan of action? What are you going to do?
Well, we're just very upset about this latest move by the mall. I don't know if we had thought they would not get in any more animals. We certainly hope so. But they seem to, have been making overtures over the years about bringing in animals. At one point, they wanted to set up an actual zoo at the mall with elephants and tigers and the whole bit. They seem to have sort of an obsession with bringing in wild animals. They have some guy who has a natural park or whatever, sort of a roadside zoo in Alberta, who brings in bear cubs and tiger cubs on a regular basis. So I suppose in some ways I wasn't really all that surprised.
Mm-hmm. Tova, do you think that Edmontonians are becoming more sympathetic to your protests and to not having animals performing there?
Oh, absolutely. We had very, very strong support while we were trying to get Howard out. There was something in the paper almost constantly, and there was just a feeling in Edmonton that people were upset about seeing this lone dolphin.
Right.
So I think, yeah, people were, I think there was a huge shift. I think there has been over the years, but this kind of, there was a special sort of sympathy for Howard.
Well, let's all hope that after 11 dolphins died at the hands of West Edmonton Mall, let's hope that at least the sea lions are treated better, perhaps, or that our protests can be strong enough that they actually bow to the pressure again and get them out of there. Tova, could you give us your website so people could get more information?
Sure. We haven't gotten anything up there about sea lions yet, but we will. It's the number four,
mm-hmm.
www.v4a.org. Yeah.
And is there an email and a number that we could actually contact the mall to step up the pressure?
Yes. I think the always the best person to contact at the mall is Gary Hansen,
mm-hmm.
who is the he's the general manager.
And do you have his email?
Yes, it's gm mm-hmm. at westedmontonmall.com.
Excellent.
And if people ever, you know, if you miss any information that we're giving on the program, you can always write us directly at animalvoices@caut.fm, and we can pass on any information that our guests have given as well. So if you didn't catch her website that she gave or those numbers, we can always pass them on to you as well.
Tova, thanks so much for being with us and updating this issue for us.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks for your work.
Well, that was Tova Rees talking to us from the Voice for Animal Society in Edmonton about West Edmonton Mall importing 3 sea lions from Scotland at a cost of $50,000 each. So I think a whole new protest is going to be started again against that terrible mall.
And they're from Scotland, but where are they coming from? Exactly?
Scotland.
But where?
Oh, they were born in captivity.
They were born in captivity. It was like a zoo, do you know, or was it?
I think another aquatic park of some sort. We're going to move right on to the next story about Rebecca Aldworth. The Humane Society for the United States has named Rebecca Aldworth Director of Canadian Wildlife Issues. The new position reflects a renewed and strengthened commitment by the HSUS to protect seals and a wide range of other wildlife species throughout Canada. Aldworth comes to the HSUS after 7 years with the International Fund for Animal Welfare, where she served as their principal campaigner against the slaughter of seals in Canada. Her new position, based in Montreal, will initially focus on her continuing work to stop the seal hunt. Rebecca, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much.
Hi, Rebecca.
Hi there.
First off, congratulations on your new position. This is very exciting.
Thank you very much. I think it's not only exciting for me, I think it's very exciting for the animal protection movement in Canada and for the campaigns that we're all working on together.
Yes, you had mentioned that to me before, that the excitement for Canada and the seals. Could you expand on that a bit more?
Absolutely. Well, I think many people would be surprised to know that that a lot of international animal protection and environmental organizations that we think of today actually started in Canada, but actually had to leave because they were underfunded and raised funds elsewhere to be able to come back into this country and fight for animals and their environment. And good examples of that include the International Fund for Animal Welfare and Greenpeace and the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society. So we have a wonderful opportunity with HSUS investing in this country, both by bringing on staff to help wage these campaigns, but also bringing the strength of their 8 million members and the clout of their organization to this very, very long-standing campaign to save the seal.
I think that's absolutely fascinating. Why did they approach you to create this specific role in Canada?
Well, HSUS has campaigned to save the seals for many years. As you know, this fight against Canada's commercial seal hunt has been ongoing for more than 3 decades. Mm-hmm. It's involved a host of organizations both in Canada and around the world, and HSUS has campaigned on this issue for many, many years. At this point, I think HSUS, like most international organizations, has come to the conclusion that it will be Canadians who make the final decision to end this hunt. It will mm-hmm. be Canadians who influence the government that continues to promote and subsidize this industry, and it will be Canadians who have the power to put a final end to it. And so for HSUS, I think this is a really important step. They realize that they need to have a presence in Canada to fight this campaign effectively, and they've taken action to do that, and I'm very, very grateful that they have, and I think a lot of groups in this country are very grateful that they have.
For those who don't know, could you just give us the details of the seal hunt and sort of the statistics about the seals?
For sure. This is the world's largest slaughter of marine mammals. 353,000 seals were killed this year, and that's the most that have been killed in more than half a century. It's a hunt for pups. More than 95% of the animals killed are just days or weeks old. They're hunted for their skins, and the skins end up being shipped almost entirely in a raw state, an unprocessed state, to Europe. The carcasses are almost entirely left on the ice or in the water to rot. So in many instances, I refer to this as a single organ trade because it's a hunt that only is after one product. The skins are used for everything from linings of shoes to fur trim for fur coats to designer items that appear in the runways in Paris and Italy. So it's an industry that is, you know, obviously dependent on people to buy the products. But interestingly, those markets are almost entirely found internationally. There's very few seal products that are sold in Canada. And the reason for that is very simple. The majority of this country opposes this hunt, doesn't want to buy the products, and that's why we have to ship them all overseas.
I think a lot of times this issue gets framed as being about labor, and I was wondering if you could talk about that a little bit. You know, that people will say, well, I don't want to support the seal hunt, but, you know, it's jobs for Canadians, or it's First Nations people who are doing this work.
Culture of the East.
Yeah. You know, and I was just wondering if you could respond to that and how HSUS plans to address that issue.
For sure. Well, first of all, I'd like to say that I grew up in a sealing community in Newfoundland, so I know a few things about what this hunt is and what it's not. Economically, the contribution of the seal hunt, even in Newfoundland, where 93% of the hunt goes on, is very marginal. There's only about 4,000 people that engage in the seal hunt in Newfoundland, and you know that's less than 1% of the population of Newfoundland. The average take-home pay for sealers, even in record-high pelt price years, is about $1,000 Canadian after their costs. So it's some money. It's about 1/20th of the average income of a fisherman. It's not anybody's primary source of income, and I can guarantee it is not money that could not easily be replaced by the Canadian government simply by investing in other industries. So there's a lot of misconceptions. People who think that this is an Aboriginal hunt are just simply wrong. This hunt is almost entirely conducted by non-Native people from Canada's East Coast. No organization, I think, that's involved in this debate is arguing with Native subsistence hunting. But what we're talking about here is a non-Aboriginal, industrial-scale slaughter of wild animals. And again, it is the largest hunt for marine mammals anywhere in the world. The other thing that I think people need to realize, you know, or question really, when we defend this seal hunt and people's rights to do it, I think we have to ask ourselves what we're actually defending. What kind of work is it that we're defending? Because the people that participate in the seal hunt will be the first people to tell you that this is dehumanizing, dangerous work. It's backbreaking labor. They go out in small boats way out into the ocean into heavy and dangerous ice conditions. Their boats often get damaged, and they end up paying a lot of money because the insurance company won't insure them for that. And the people out there on the ice are occasionally lost on the ice floes. They get injured. And, of course, I think there's very few people out there that enjoy clubbing or shooting to death baby seals for a living.
Right.
So I think the question is, can the Canadian government not invest in something better for the people of Canada's East Coast? Because this industry certainly is not bringing in money for the individuals involved. And what it is doing is putting at risk legitimate industries like tourism in Canada, because people, quite frankly, don't want to support this country knowing that their tourism dollars are being used to subsidize this industry.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned clubbing. I feel like these are, you know, this is the image that we have, or at least I have in my head, of the seal hunt. It sounds like it's a slaughterhouse on the ice, basically, or in these natural areas. Is clubbing still kind of the primary way that these animals are killed?
Clubbing is one of the primary ways that animals are killed at the seal hunt, also shooting. So the hunt takes place in two areas in Canada, in the Gulf of St. Lawrence, which is west of Newfoundland, and in an area that we call the Front, which is northeast of Newfoundland. In the Gulf of St. Lawrence, seals are primarily clubbed to death, and so this year about 98,000 seals were clubbed to death in the Gulf of St. Lawrence. In the Front, because the ice is more broken up, because it's farther out to sea, seals tend to be shot rather than clubbed. But you have to bear in mind that the sealers are shooting at seals from moving boats, and of course the seals are moving and the ice is moving.
Right.
And so often seals will only be injured. Sealers are loath to shoot a seal more than once, because for every bullet hole that they result in the skin, the processing companies take off $2. So what will happen is that the fishermen will pull their boats up alongside the ice pan where the wounded seal is writhing around. They'll lean over the side of the boat with a long wooden pole with a boat hook on the end called a gaff, and they'll hook the animal through the skull or the tail or the flipper or anything they can reach. They'll drag the conscious animal often up on board the boat, sometimes pulling them 10 feet up in the air, and then club them on board the boat. So there is clubbing that goes on up at the Front, contrary to what the Canadian government would like us to believe. And in many ways, shooting is often much more cruel than clubbing.
Rebecca, I would just like to say that for all our United States listeners, I'm happy to say that John Kerry is one of the senators in the states that is opposing the seal hunt.
Yes.
So I just wanted to, you know, give that shout out.
Well, I think it's fantastic that 21 senators co-sponsored a resolution in the U.S. Senate asking Canada to stop the seal hunt. And I think that just shows how high level the opposition to this practice is internationally. It's the Canadian government who is not listening to that international opposition or to the will of the Canadian people. And again, the majority of us oppose this hunt. You know, I've spent 6 years looking at this hunt firsthand. I bring journalists, veterinarians, scientists, and I go up to the hunt and I land in the middle of it, mm-hmm. and I walk people right over to see it for themselves. And this is an issue that is very hard to support or to be opposed to until you've actually seen the images for yourself. It's very hard to believe this stuff can actually go on in Canada. Mm-hmm. And when people see it, they're changed forever. There is not a thinking, compassionate human being out there who can go up to this hunt and look at it and come away thinking that this is something our society should allow to continue.
Mm. Well, Rebecca, bless you for doing all that.
Well, thank you. And, you know, I thank you very much for the opportunity to be on your show and to speak to Canadian animal protection groups that I will be in constant contact with over the next few months.
I hope you're in contact with us because we'd love to keep talking with you and follow your campaign.
Definitely.
Thank you very much.
So could you give us some more details about your role as Director of Canadian Wildlife Issues? And you had some interesting things to say to me about the evolution of the Canadian animal rights community and what you hope to accomplish in your new role.
Well, I think one of the biggest problems facing Canadian groups is just the geography of our country. We have a lot of small, underfunded organizations in this country who, unfortunately, are quite separate from each other. Mm-hmm. I think it is vital for animal protection in Canada that groups start to develop a common strategy and common ways of campaigning in this country. And that's not to say that everything will be identical from coast to coast, but it's to say that some groups have experiences others don't, and it's important that we share skills and thoughts and opinions and goals so that we're all working from the same area. I hope that HSUS can play a really important role, that I can play a really important role over the coming months in giving organizations the support that they need, not only to work on the commercial seal hunt, but to work on a lot of wildlife issues in Canada and other issues in Canada affecting animals. It's very important to me that the Canadian animal protection movement grows. As I was saying earlier, there's a lot of international groups, including Greenpeace and IFAW, who originated in Canada, but because they were unable to raise the funds necessary to campaign here effectively, had to actually leave our country and set up internationally and then come back into the country with the funds needed to wage these campaigns. I think it's very important that Canadian citizens start putting money into the groups that need it so desperately to work on behalf of animals who have no voice. And so it's going to be very important that groups get much more sophisticated, that we work together very closely on our strategic plans, and that we start getting very political in this country, because there are two things that will win us victories for animals. One is economics and one is politics. And if the groups are not out there during the election supporting candidates and working against other candidates who may not favor animal protection, the government is simply not going to listen to us, and we're not going to get the legislation we need to protect animals. So I hope very much that over the coming months I can be a part of facilitating communication and strategic thinking amongst the groups in Canada.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I wanted to follow up with you about, you know, this sense of trying to build alliances across a very large area. How do you see that happening? How do you see the dialogue actually occurring?
Well, there is already a lot of dialogue that started. There's some fantastic people in this country. I mean, Sandra Carlson is one of them with Animals Canada. Technology is helping us greatly. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I came into this movement back in 1994, I think the concept of sending an email back then was so
right.
new mm-hmm. and so frightening. And now we have listservs and we have websites and we have chat rooms and abilities to communicate that we simply didn't have 10 years ago. I think that's a huge thing that will help us move forward. I think the thing that's missing is a common forum where we can bring groups together, whether it be, you know, once a year or once every couple of years, in this country to talk about Canadian issues.
Right.
What you often find is Canadian groups going down to animal rights conferences in the States, and, you know, we always find sort of a back room somewhere to, to talk. I think it's important that we set up our own forums, that we learn about Canadian politics, that we learn about Canadian law, and that we give ourselves the tools that the animals need us to have so that we can go out and win these victories. That, again, I think is going to be a very important step in moving the animal protection movement forward in this country.
Rebecca, it is just thrilling to hear you talk about this stuff, because I think it's exactly what Canada needs. And especially now that I think the animal cruelty bill is about to be tabled again in the Canadian Senate.
Yes, it is. It's
a good time for us to really pool our resources and work together. What do you see as your first plan of action?
Well, the first thing that I need to do is start reconnecting with organizations across the country. One of the big things that we've been lacking in this campaign is a strong coalition of Canadian organizations that are working together with a common plan. So one of the first things I will be doing is just simply trolling through the country, taking up people's time, sitting down and meeting with them and talking about the issues of the hunt, educating people about what's going on out there, making sure that people have the resources they need to campaign, whether that be footage or photographs or facts or reports. And then I think the next step is to start getting people working politically. As you noted, I mean, we have a minority government situation, which means that NGOs and your average constituent has so much more power than in a normal election cycle. And, of course, we will likely, as is predicted, have an election coming up very soon. So this is really a time to campaign very strongly for animals across this country and to show politicians in Canada what Canadians want and the fact that animal protection is an important issue for almost all Canadians, and that it's time for the political system to reflect that and for individual politicians to speak out on these issues.
I find it very heartening when you say that, you know, most Canadians don't want the seal hunt. Most Canadians, you know, don't want to see animals treated badly. Of course, there are those Canadians, though, who don't necessarily care or don't find these particularly meaningful issues, especially during an election period, you know, that it's sort of sideline. And I'm sure that you experience or are going to experience some resistance. What are some of the critiques or some of the friction that you imagine happening in the future, and how do you hope to address that?
Well, in Canada, the biggest problem we have is that journalists have not reported on this issue very consistently. And so while we've been able to convince journalists from around the world, leading journalists from around the world, to come up and view the hunt, we've had a lot of difficulty simply getting Canadian journalists to actually come up and look at it and report on it. One of the frustrating things in Canada is that what makes this hunt newsworthy is the simple graphic cruelty that we witness up there each and every year. This year, for example, in 2004, one of the most horrific incidents I've ever seen was a seal that was left in a dead pile that was still conscious and trying to crawl and had been clubbed and was left to suffocate in her own blood for more than an hour. And we had no way of euthanizing this seal, and the only thing I could do was to beg these sealers to come back and kill this seal. And they refused to for more than an hour. And when I called the Department of Fisheries and Oceans and asked them to go up and enforce the regulations, they said, and I quote, "We don't have time today." This is the kind of thing that goes on up there. That footage that we filmed was played in BBC One and BBC World as one of their headline stories. We could not get that footage aired in Canada. So I think this is one of the big problems facing us. People very much see this as an election issue. They see it as a voting issue. The problem is that until they know what's going on and how serious the cruelty is up at this hunt, until they actually get the information they need, it's hard to convince them that this is something they should care about. I think one of the other problems that we face is that our country, our federal government, I should say, is increasingly loath to get involved in what they consider to be regional issues. So they talk about this being Newfoundland's problem, and you know, Newfoundland should make the decision on it. Well, the response to that is very simple. Seals are migratory. They don't belong to Canada. They don't certainly don't belong to Newfoundland. And it is the responsibility of every person around the globe to protect these animals for future generations and to prevent the kind of cruelty that we consistently film each and every year that we go up there. So there's a number of arguments that you will be hit with about why people shouldn't care about this issue. But I will come back and say, for animal protection organizations and for the general public, seals have become a symbol of something far greater than this hunt. This is the world's largest marine mammal hunt, and it's, in my opinion, the cruelest, and that alone means it's something we should work together to stop right now. But seals have become a symbol of the animal protection movement and the successes that we made in the 1980s.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's very important that we get this victory back. It's a victory, and I would argue the victory, that we had in the animal protection movement. It wasn't about whether or not there was enough seals, whether there was only two left, and therefore we had to stop hunting them. We asked a very simple question to society. Do we allow people to do this to this species? And the answer was no. And that was a very important mark for the animal protection community. And to have lost that has a serious, serious implication for what we're trying to do in many other campaigns. So I just argue to all the people that I talk to out there that this is a victory that belongs to us, and it's an important victory for the seals that are affected by the hunt every year, by the people who are forced to live with this cruelty each and every year, and for Canada's international reputation. And I think it's something that groups in Canada agree we need to end now and permanently.
Rebecca, one last question. We talk a lot about on the show about surviving activist burnout. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, with all that you've seen and done, mm-hmm. what keeps you going?
It's a very difficult question to answer, especially this year, because I think we negotiated with the Department of Fisheries and Oceans to get closer to the hunt than we've ever been. So we were just 10 meters away, which, quite frankly, is about as close as you want to get to someone holding a hackapick who really doesn't like you.
Mm-hmm.
But we saw some incredibly brutal things this year. And for me, personally, it's very difficult because I'm watching people that I grew up around doing this to animals and threatening me, and it's very difficult. But that being said, what I witness up there is nothing compared to what those animals go through. And for me, I guess what keeps me going are the animals that I've watched die, because I stood there and I watched those animals die and I filmed them die, and I made a mental promise to them that that would mean something.
Mm.
And so everything that I do, I take those images with me and I turn them into productive outrage and action. And that's the only way I can define it. Burnout occurs when you feel that you will not win. I know that we will win. I don't just think we will win. I know we will win. I am absolutely convinced of it. The only question is when.
Rebecca, I actually have one last question, too. You know, you paint a very vivid picture about, you know, standing there, you're videotaping, these animals are dying in really gruesome ways, and you have people that are sometimes threatening you. Is there any attempt to dialogue with hunters? I mean, you said, you know, this issue is going to be decided by Canadians. Is it also partially about trying to dialogue with those people as well? Is there any point in that? And does HSUS, you know, support kind of trying to build conversations across between the hunters as well as the activists?
I think you're absolutely correct in what you're saying here. I think it will be Canadians, and ultimately, in the very long term, it will be Newfoundlanders who make this decision. And in reality, a handful of Newfoundlanders who will make this decision. Dialoguing with people in the coastal communities in Newfoundland is incredibly important. For one thing, most people who live in coastal communities in Newfoundland don't participate in the hunt and have no idea what's going on out there. Secondly, we need to actually sit down with the people who are earning money from this hunt and talk to them about what other industries they could see replacing this. To me, we have so much common ground. This is tough, dangerous work for the people who are doing it,
mm-hmm.
and we don't like the hunt for that reason and because we want to protect the seals. There is an answer here that we can both agree to. And the only question is, what is that answer, and how can we both come to some sort of an understanding? So HSUS is incredibly committed to dialoguing with people in coastal communities and finding out how we can support the Canadian government investing funds in alternate industries, industries that will actually promise a future to outport Newfoundland,
mm-hmm.
to future generations of Newfoundlanders. The seal hunt will not do that. The people who live in coastal communities know that. And so the question is, how can we help get the Canadian government to put real funds and real energy and real thought behind what they can do in outport to bolster the economy there. You know, you're absolutely right that that discussion needs to happen, and I am absolutely committed to doing that. I know sealers, my family knows sealers, and I have had a number of conversations with the people in the industry, and what you hear often surprises you. How little money people make, how people are treated on board those boats and by the industry, and what kind of a life it is for them to participate in this hunt, and how many of them would quite happily grab onto something else if it was provided for them. So once we start building those allies in Newfoundland, I think we will start to shatter the federal government's, I call it the brick wall of support for the hunt. Mm. And once we start to break that apart, I think, you know, a real permanent victory will be in sight for us.
Rebecca, we have to go. We are out of time. But it has been an enlightening conversation, and I thank you so much for joining us, and best of luck in your new role.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Rebecca.
Take care. Bye-bye.
We were speaking with Rebecca Aldworth, the newly appointed Director of Canadian Wildlife Issues for the Humane Society of the United States. Next on the show is Sarah Jane Bloom, media spokesperson for the group GourmetCruelty.com. And she was arrested last year on April 23, 2004, after screening their undercover documentary, Delicacy of Despair, behind the closed doors of the foie gras industry at New York State's Syracuse University. She is charged with felony burglary and facing 7 years in prison, along with Ryan Shapiro, who was arraigned last week. Sarah Jane, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, we didn't get a chance to discuss exactly what you can legally discuss with us today. Perhaps you can start by telling us what led to the charges that you and Ryan face, and how much you are legally able to divulge.
Okay. Ryan and I have been charged with felony burglary for our involvement with investigating the conditions at Hudson Valley Foie Gras Factory Farm in New York State. And this investigation led to the subsequent rescue of several ducks from this factory farm. And this was done in conjunction with a larger investigation into the entire foie gras industry in the U.S. and the rescue of 15 injured and suffering ducks from factory farms in New York and California.
Can you tell us exactly like what was involved in the investigation? Like, I assume you actually went to the foie gras farm.
Yeah. Basically, we just went back to the foie gras farms as many times as we could to fully document the conditions that are inherent to the production of foie gras. Because foie gras, for people who aren't familiar with it, is a French term which means fat liver. And it's considered a delicacy product that is the fattened liver of a duck or goose, which has been just created through the gross overfeeding of this poor animal. Essentially, a duck or goose has a giant metal pipe shoved down his throat up to 3 times a day. Through this pipe, he's forced to ingest up to a pound of food that is just through essentially like a pneumatic process, just through an air compressor, just pumping food down this bird's throat until he chokes or he suffocates or his stomach explodes. And so both to document the feeding process, which is so cruel, most people don't believe it could possibly be legal, and to document the conditions which are part and parcel of this industry, of this process, where you see birds suffering in their own vomit, birds dead and dying just in these tiny isolation cages and in these filthy, filthy pens. Birds who are just in isolation cages so small they can barely move, much less like spread their wings or turn around or do anything. And birds just in these filthy pens suffering one next to the other with their dead and dying brethren. And so what we tried to do was just go in with good video cameras and let these birds tell their story.
Hmm. You know, it's interesting with a lot of open rescues. This was an open rescue, I assume, right?
Yes.
That a lot of times it seems like the companies are, this is true, although I guess in Australia, there's been a lot of open rescues and people have and have not been arrested. But oftentimes it's a media nightmare for these companies if people are arrested and they decide to press charges. Do you see this as an opportunity to raise more awareness about the foie gras industry?
What's interesting is that in the United States, there have been several groups who have used these tactics, who have done these sorts of undercover investigations and open rescues before we did, and nobody ever chose to prosecute somebody because it's obvious that anyone who walked onto a factory farm and saw this sort of suffering would be moved by their conscience to try to help these animals, and that most often a farmer would like to look at this footage and go, oh no, that's not my farm, you know, and if addressed by the media or by the public, most times farmers will go, oh no, that's not my farm. But because foie gras is such a small industry, farmers have been forced to go, yes, this is how we do this, and stand up and take their stands. Why they've decided that this should be a legal issue, I couldn't really tell you.
I mean, you're facing 7 years in prison, correct?
Yes.
Did you expect that kind of charge after you, I believe it, you were arrested after you screened the documentary. Is that correct? And did you expect those charges?
I certainly was shocked by every element of the legal proceedings thus far. I certainly did not expect one day after screening the video at Syracuse University and just talking to compassionate people about things they can do to help suffering ducks to be thrown into a cop car and brought across several county lines and brought down to Liberty, New York. I didn't expect that. I didn't expect these charges. But all I can say is that I hope it means that everyone is paying attention. I hope it means that everyone recognizes that this sort of animal suffering will not go unnoticed by the public.
And Ryan was arrested or arraigned last week. Why is that?
Again, like I said, I could not be more shocked by the way this legal situation has proceeded.
They're just moving to like the next person involved kind of thing?
I would assume that they have their strategy for why they decided at this point to bring him in on these charges. Fortunately, we have an incredible lawyer, and the incredible lawyer was able to make it so that Ryan did not have to go through the same difficult and trying situation that I did, where I was actually, you know, arrested and handcuffed and put in shackles and brought to my arraignment. He was able to arrange to turn himself in a much more civilized manner.
It's pretty incredible, but in some ways, I don't know. I mean, I don't know where you're at right now in terms of how you feel about what's going on and what's going on with you and you potentially facing this jail time. But in some ways, it's heartening because it makes me feel that perhaps these companies and the legal system feels that you're a threat, that you could actually, you know, do something to jeopardize the viability of this industry, that they have to respond with such huge, you know, repercussions. Do you take any kind of hope in that? I don't know. I don't know what it's like at this point for you and how you're seeing everything.
I would definitely say that for me, I choose to think of this as proof that everyone is paying attention to the suffering of these ducks and geese, and, you know, a less immediate level, that if people are starting to pay more and more attention to the animal suffering on factory farms. You know, what I face, what Ryan faces, is nothing compared to what these animals go through every day. And so the more we can keep the attention on the animals, the better I feel.
And what do you think is going to happen?
I wish I knew. I mean,
no
I
guesses,
hope that,
eh?
I hope that they'll realize that the case should be dropped and that rather than prosecuting us, they should prosecute the real criminals, you know, the people who are torturing animals on factory farms in New York. I think it's an incredible irony that even as foie gras is being banned in California, the only other state that produces it, we're the ones being prosecuted in New York State.
Yes, I mean, that must add some kind of validity to your actions in the eyes of the court. I expect that you'll use that as part of your defense. Are you able to tell us any details of your next steps and about your defense?
The one thing I've learned about legal proceedings through all this is that they're slower than you could possibly imagine. Like all other American bureaucracies, the legal system moves much more slowly than I would have ever imagined. And so not only can I not really talk about our next legal step, I couldn't even tell you our next legal step necessarily.
Okay. I wonder, have you spoken with any workers from Hudson Valley Foie Gras Farm about this, and are any sort of on your side?
I have not personally spoken with many workers from Hudson Valley Foie Gras, but the foie gras industry in America has long been noted as one of the most difficult for workers, the most unpleasant worker conditions, the most kind of really abhorrent and anachronistic workplace that can be found in the United States today. Mm. I mean, workers are forced to work for, you know, a month without a day off. And in fact, you know, labor groups have long tried to get the industry to reform or shut down just because of how cruel it is to the humans as well as the non-human animals who are forced to be involved with it. So.
And how is the public sentiment in New York growing towards foie gras?
I think if my experience shows anything, it's that the public sentiment is very much with us, that most people have no idea that 80% of the foie gras produced in the United States is produced in one county in New York State. And as people learn it, they go, I don't want this in my neighborhood. I don't want this in my state. There's legislation pending in New York to create a similar ban to the one that has been passed in California. And I think that very much shows that there is a strong sentiment against this sort of animal cruelty in New York State.
Can I ask how your organization feels about that California ban? We're going to have Gary Francione on, I think, next week to talk more about the legalities of that issue. But how do you feel about it?
I think that everyone should be incredibly pleased that not only has legislation, you know, spoken to the foie gras issue, that we now have legislation on the books that bans animal cruelty. This is not kind of an example of legislation that gives animals slightly bigger cages, that gives animals slightly more water while they're still being forced to suffer in essentially the same conditions they were in before. This says force feeding is inherently cruel, and California will not stand for it. Certainly, I wish that the ban would be enacted tomorrow or yesterday or 10 years ago rather than in 2012. But I think we should all be aware that this is real legislation that is banning animal cruelty in the United States of America, despite the fact that it's a very profitable business practice. And I think we should all be really touched by all the people who stepped forward and said, this isn't worth it. This sort of animal cruelty is not something we need in California.
So how is it looking in New York in terms of the government and the senators? Are they close to signing this bill into law just like California?
The New York road has been much rockier, both because the foie gras industry has such a firmer hold and because it's funny. Hudson Valley Foie Gras has said there is no way to produce foie gras without the forced feeding of animals. And so,
yet they say it's natural.
Yeah, I think we'd need a much longer radio show if I had to tell you all the time they've lied.
Indeed.
But I think that it's going to be a much more straightforward process of saying, despite your opposition, this is not a practice New Yorkers are comfortable with. And so far, the governor has not taken a position on it, but there are very sympathetic legislators and senators who have been moving this bill forward and are going to keep pushing it. And I think that it's too early to say what the exact ramifications of the California bill are on it, but when the next legislative session starts, I think we're definitely going to see kind of renewed interest in this animal legislation.
And how can the general public help you in this case? What can we do?
I think everyone should go and visit gourmetcruelty.com, which is our website. There you can learn about how you can write into your legislators and get them to support the New York State bill, or you don't even have to be a New York State resident. Just let people know that the world is watching and the world cares about this sort of animal cruelty. You can also find out what you can do to show the footage from our undercover investigation, show our video, Delicacy of Despair, and get restaurant managers, you know, get people in your community to stop eating and selling foie gras. That's a huge thing. There also is a link where you can donate to our legal defense. And even though we have an incredible lawyer who is taking our case at much reduced rates, legal fees are mounting every day. So everybody's support is incredibly appreciated. But most importantly, every time anyone can show the footage, show the video, show the pictures, let the birds speak for themselves, we'll be going a long way to stop this animal cruelty.
And people can get that documentary from your website?
Yes.
I'll just tell our Toronto listeners, too, that that we have Toronto restaurants listed on our website that currently sell foie gras. And one that we listed actually got back to us and said they no longer sell foie gras because people were concerned about the cruelty. So little actions like that do go a long way. One last question for you, Sarah Jane, and I think Lauren kind of addressed this before, but you must be under tremendous strain, and we ask activists this a lot, but what keeps you going?
The first time I ever stepped onto a factory farm, I made a promise to the animals there that I wouldn't stop and I wouldn't give up until I had done all I could to save all of them, to help all of them. And I remember that promise every night, and I'm not going to quit now, you know, because there are still 500,000 ducks suffering on foie gras factory farms in the United States, and, you know, 10 billion animals on factory farms in the United States suffering and dying every year. And so I can't give up on them.
Sarah Jane, you are truly an inspiration. And I wish you best of luck in your case. Please let us know how it goes and if there's anything we can do to help.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks. Sarah Jane.
That was Sarah Jane from GourmetCruelty.com. Please go to their website and help them in their case. And if you're in the States, please write your legislators to support them in their case and get that legislation in place in New York. Well, I'm kind of inspired by these activists who have done so much and are facing so much and just find a way to keep going.
Mm-hmm.
I find it difficult to talk about the seal hunt and about foie gras and to keep going myself just talking about it, but these are people who are actually faced with it and just put one foot in front of the other and keep on going. So more power to all of you and best of luck.
You've been listening to Animal Voices, CIUT 89.5. Please check out our website, www.animalvoices.ca. There's archive programs on the site as well as information about who we are. And there's also a chance for you to fill out a survey. You can tell us more about who you are and what you'd like to hear on upcoming Animal Voices as well. Thanks to Rob Moore, all of our guests, and Lamia for coming in and doing the program today. CIUT 89.5.